some of the surprise may have already been taken care of, but I want to start by asking you if you are aware of the terrible jokes that are sometimes told by sort of making a parody on scripture verses. So, for example, do you know the first automobile to have been mentioned in the Bible? It's a Honda, because it says the disciples were all in one accord. And make those kinds of jokes. Okay. I can remember more than 40 years ago, and I don't remember now if it was one of the, this is going to be gender insensitive, one of the old maid women in my church who told the story, or whether the story was told in her presence to sort of tweak at her. But the story was that there was a woman of a certain age who was not married and was asked by friends of hers at church why she was not, and she said she was just following scripture, which caused them to ask, what scripture are you following? And she said, Romans 1:13, except she moved a comma so that it came out, I would not have you, ignorant brethren. Now, in Romans 1:13, there is a critical comma that is placed after the word ignorant and not before it that makes that joke function and better. I have laughed about that joke for years and years and years, and I have finally decided that today might be the day to explore a little bit that subject. So, as we begin, I think it's very important to begin at the right place. What is ignorance? What does it mean to be ignorant?
Uninformed.
Naive.
Perhaps there's a connotation that you aren't necessarily open to learning what there is to know.
We in our day have put a negative connotation on that word. Ignorant implies you shouldn't be ignorant, as opposed to ignorant as a description of where you happen to be. My students are often caught up short early in courses that I teach when I tell them that all of them are ignorant. If they weren't, they wouldn't need the course I'm teaching. And that my job is to help them with that ignorance.
Your sensitive side cannot be right.
That also is not as sensitive as it should be. Okay. Now, what is the other word that our culture lays alongside of this word?
Stupid.
Stupid or stupidity. Okay. There's a cliche that I've heard once that says ignorance may be temporary, but stupidity is permanent. I heard someone say you can't fix stupid. What does the word stupid mean? And listen carefully to the contrast between these two. What does the word stupid mean?
Unable
to learn. What does ignorance mean? Unlearned. Okay? Now, you can edge this word a little bit without leaving its fairly neutral meaning. Remember, in our day, we have put a negative connotation on that word in many parts. The interesting consequence is, if you look in modern translations, they will avoid the use of that word mostly. King James in Romans 1:13 says, I would not have you ignorant, comma, brethren. Others, translations, NIV, New Living, and others like that, will say something like, there's something I want you to be certain about. There's something I really want to make sure you know. And you understand, it's really saying the same thing, but it's taking away this word that has these negative connotations. Leaving those negative connotations aside, leaving the neutral use of that word, right? The sources of this can be uneducated, unlearned, uninformed. It could also be mistaken, and it could also be mistaken in the sense of I thought something and I was wrong. It could be somebody taught me to think something and they were not informing me correctly. So it could be misled or deceived. Right? And so for just a moment, I want us to look at a few places. Start in Acts chapter 3. And I want you to see a contrast between the first two that I take you to. Acts chapter 3. Many of you will be aware that Acts chapter 3 comes a short time after Pentecost, we think. But probably within the first year after the crucifixion and resurrection, maybe within the first few months. And it begins with Peter and John going to the temple. It seems that this is a regular thing for them to do. The Christians would actually gather in the temple grounds and would have services or gatherings of some kind. And on their way, there was a man the Bible describes as crippled from birth. He was healed by the actions of Peter and John. And a great crowd gathered to try to find out what was going on. And the crowd kept growing and growing and growing. And if you come to verse 11, everyone came running toward them in great excitement. It tells you where. The man who had been healed was still clinging to Peter and John. When Peter saw the people, he addressed them. He began to talk to them. He used this as a chance to speak to them. And what he spoke to them about was Jesus, crucified and resurrected. And at the end of this, in chapter 4, the religious leaders came up and arrested them. They were so put out. It says in verse 2 of chapter 4, the religious leaders were extremely annoyed at their teaching. Verse 3, so they arrested them. So this is the context in which this is set. Now, in the middle of Peter's comments, he says something in verse 17. If you're in the King James Version, what you read here is, it was through ignorance that you, that is the people of Jerusalem, did this to Jesus and your rulers also. Now my translation once again takes away the word ignorant. Yours probably does too if you have a modern translation. Mine says, I know, brothers, that neither you nor your leaders had any idea what you were really doing. Okay, so the use of the word ignorant is in there. Any comments before we go to the next one?
Mine says, I know that you acted in ignorance.
Acted in ignorance. Somehow the word ignorant isn't used. Ignorance can be that when you just change the form of the word. Sometimes that shows up. Okay, so chapter 4, the religious leaders finally come, see this great crowd, see Peter talking about Jesus' resurrection. So they arrest him. And as they get him into the private places where the gathering of religious leaders is there essentially to judge him, he begins to speak back to them. And verse 8 says he does that under what influence? Filled with the Holy Spirit, he begins to speak. And he begins to talk to them about this. Verse 13 gives their reaction. What's the verb? Or what's the phrase that's used to express their reaction to Peter's speaking? Mine says they were astonished. Don't go to their description of them. It's the reaction is astonishment or amazement. Why were they astonished and amazed? Because Peter and John were, if you look at King James, it says unlearned and ignorant. Okay? Yours, Rhonda said?
Uneducated.
That's what mine says too. And mine says another word. Mine says uneducated layman. Ordinary people doesn't quite convey it. What's the word layman? When we talk about layman in the church, what point are we making?
They're not
the professional, theologically trained ministerial staff. Untrained would be a way of saying that. So mine says layman, yours says untrained. Both of us, Rhonda seemed to say, uneducated and untrained. How can they be talking this way when they are ignorant of how people carry such conversations? Okay? Now, again, we're not looking too much further into it. Turn to Acts chapter 17 for just a moment. Acts chapter 17. Now, since we were here just last week, I can appeal to most of you. Ernie and Kim are off the hook, but the rest of you, I think, are still on the hook. You may remember we were in this section last week, looking at Paul's travels into Greece the first time he came into Europe with his party of evangelists. Remember that Luke appears to have joined him in the middle of chapter 16. There's that change from they and them to we and us. Remember that. So here he is in chapter 17. The troubles have come. He's been driven out of place after place after place. Finally, they sent him on ahead by himself to Athens. And chapter 17 includes his discussion, his debate, his dialogue with the people in the Areopagus. This was the place where the learned people, the philosophers of Athens, would gather. Okay? And he begins to talk to them about the idols that they have set up for people to worship. And the fact that they have one place where they have a little sign up that says, to the unknown God. And Paul says, that's the God I'm telling you about, the one you don't seem to know about. And so in verse 26 and 27 and 28, he begins to talk about this. Verse 27, for example, he did all these things so that they might seek God, and by feeling their way towards him, succeed in finding him. And indeed, God is not far from any of us, since it is in him that we live and move and exist. As indeed some of your own writers have said, and he quotes one of the Greek philosophers. Now, verse 29, since we are the children of God, we have no excuse for thinking that God looks anything like something made from gold, silver, or stone that has been carved or designed by man. But, overlooking the times of ignorance, God is now telling everyone that they must repent. Now, that phrase says, this has been the behavior of people. They've been building idols, carving idols, making idols, and worshiping idols. And God has overlooked that because they're ignorant. They don't know any better. Now, because of Jesus having come, he'll say in a few moments, now the evidence is here for what really is going on. And when you started worshiping the unknown God, I want to make that connection for you. But did you notice what he says? Up until now, God has overlooked these things. Why? Because people were ignorant. What does that mean in this context? They didn't know any better. You understand? What were the things that Jesus said to God about the people who were hammering the nails into his hands and into his feet at the crucifixion? What did he say? Forgive them, Father, for they don't know what they're doing. It's a direct connection to Acts 17:30. Do you see that connection? They don't know what they're doing. They are ignorant. So now we come to Romans chapter 1, verse 13. Romans chapter 1, verse 13. And the first time we see this phrase. That verse starts in my translation with, I want you to be certain, quite certain, brothers. But in King James it would read, I would not have you ignorant, brethren. Note where the comma goes. What does yours say?
Unaware.
I don't want you unaware. I want you to be certain. I don't want you to be unaware. It's a positive way of saying it, negative way of saying it. Right? Now here's what I propose. I want to take a little bit of time this morning and walk through the times that Paul uses this phrase to find out what it is that has risen to the top, as far as Paul is concerned, of the things that he wants to make sure people know. Okay? Because that's what's happening. Paul's talking about lots and lots of different things, but a few of them rise to the point he says, now listen, this one, you got to get this one. Right? And the first one looks strange by that measure. What is it he wants them to know? He's writing to the Christians in Rome. There's something he wants them to be absolutely certain about. What is that? Can you read a few verses and pick it up? Somebody read verse 13. What does it say? Somebody have that and want to read it?
I do not want you to be unaware, brothers, that I planned many times to come to you, but have been prevented from doing so until now, in order that I might have a harvest among you, just as I have had among the other Gentiles.
And that's far enough. What does he want them to know? I haven't been to see you. What conclusion could you reach? That I don't care. I want to make sure you know that my lack of being able to come to see you is not that I don't want to. He wants to make sure they know he cares. He wants to make sure they know he wants to be with them. Things just haven't worked out. Why is that important? I think it was last week. Maybe it was the week before. He gets a gift from one of the churches he served in. And he's writing back to them about this gift. Remember what he says? I'm so grateful for the gift. Not that I needed what you sent me. Remember what he said? but now I know you were thinking about me. And I realized you've been thinking about me all along. You just hadn't had a chance to show it. It's the exact reverse of what he's talking about here. I care about you, I just haven't had a chance to show it. The misunderstandings that come when people who care about each other are somehow prevented from expressing that, there's mischief in that. Big mischief in that. Big problems can come. And Paul says, I want to start. This is the front of my letter. I got lots of things to talk to you about. But the thing I want to make really sure you understand is, I care about you. And the fact that I haven't come to see you is not a signal that I don't care. For Paul, that one is personal. I don't know how deep the theology of that goes. I suspect it goes deeper than I can see right now. But for Paul, this was the most important thing to start with. It's not that I don't care. It's that every time I've tried, I just couldn't get there.
It's one of the biggest things within families, that parents and children, and as children grow up and you don't hear from them and you don't hear from them, and as parents you think, oh, they don't even think about me, they don't care, and they're just boys. You know, that's usually the answer. they have a mom.
That was gender insensitive.
But the girls will call many times. Yeah. But anyway, that's an important... It's an important thing that as parents, and when you have aging parents, you know, they call you so much because they just want to touch base with you. They want to make sure you care.
And God help you if you get onto a schedule of calling.
So I get that.
And you do. And you need to. And it's good. And I wish I could call my mom. I wish I could call my mom. I can't anymore. And I probably didn't call her enough. Let's go for the second one, a little deeper this time. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. You know the phrase to look for, right? 1 Corinthians chapter 10, look at verse 1. Does it open with that same phrase? Whatever you saw before in Romans 1:13, you should see something similar now. Okay, what is it this time? You start reading, it sounds like a history lesson. Sounds like history. Okay, I want you to know some history. Is that right? No. No. It's the history that gets you to the points. But you got to dig a bit to get the points. I'm going to give you a moment to see how well you do. I think there's at least 2 points he's making, and they are huge. Can you spot them? Read verse 1, 2, 3, 4, and then the first of verse 5. How does verse 5 start? Nevertheless, in spite of this. Okay? So what's the point he's making? Point 1. What's the point he's making? You can be actively involved in the functions of a faith community and not be a person of real faith yourself. Here was God visibly present, as actively involved in working with a people as he had ever or ever would be until Jesus came. And here everybody was having all these experiences. And for most of them, it didn't do them any good at all. Because they were part of the activities of a faith community without themselves being people of faith. And they perished. That's point one. You can be part of the activities of a faith community and not be a person of faith yourself. Someone in the first hour mentioned having met a woman who was leading the missions activity of her church and was in a worship service one day and heard the gospel message as clearly as it was ever presented and suddenly realized she had never herself made a profession of faith. And all of a sudden the things she did became much deeper, much richer. Now she both was part of the activities and a person of faith herself. You can be part of the activities of a faith community without yourself being really and truly a person of faith. But there's a second point. Read down to verse 12. Sorry, verse 6. Verse 6. What does it say in verse 6?
Our existence are to be used as examples for us in keeping our hearts set not on evil things.
You today have a chance to learn from what happened to them then, so that you can avoid the mistakes they made. One of my favorite stories, I'm pretty sure it isn't true, but oh, I wish it were. My wife is a kindergarten teacher. Yes, she's retired, but once you're a kindergarten teacher for 25 years, that's what you are for a while longer. My daughter's a kindergarten teacher. The story is the little boy shows up for kindergarten the first day dressed in a seersucker suit with a little bow tie. Think about what this kid is going to face. And a note pinned to the breast pocket of his suit. And the teacher takes the note and reads it, and the note says, and I quote, "This note is to introduce my son, Claude." Claude is a sensitive child. If Claude misbehaves, smack the child next to Claude. Claude will get the message. I don't want to trivialize what Paul is saying, but Paul is saying these folks have experienced the consequences of this. You can learn from that and not have to experience those consequences yourself. Being part of a faith community is wonderful. But being only involved in its activities and not involved in the faith itself, there's problems there. What happened to these people happened as an example for us to learn from. It's in the Bible so we can learn from it. If we read it and don't realize, wait a minute, there's parallels in my life, then we're in trouble. I want to make sure you understand. You can be part of a faith community in its activities and not be part of the faith community in its fundamental interactions with God. Okay? How are you doing so far? Let's move two chapters. 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 1. Same phrase. Maybe a little different order. You may have to go to the end of the verse to see the phrase, but that phrase is in verse 1, right? You find it? Okay, once again, read a little bit. What is it he wants them to be absolutely certain to make sure that they know? Make sure they're not ignorant of. What does he want to know? What does he... Yeah.
No,
1 Corinthians 12.
Okay.
1 Corinthians 12, verse 1. He wants them to know something about spiritual gifts. What does he want them to know? He wants them to know what they are. What are they? And I'm not looking for a list. Oh, they're this and this and this. What are they? They're gifts of God, of the abilities to do something in the spiritual realm. To lead in that, if you will, in the spiritual realm. What else? He wants them to know that they should be used to bring the church together. Sometimes they're used to split churches apart. He wants them to know that they should be used. This goes on for a long way. You have to read this chapter. You have to read Romans chapter 12. You have to read actually 1 Corinthians 13 and maybe into 14 to see the full picture of what he's talking about. This is big in terms of the scale of the words he used to talk about it. He wants them to know how important it is that each person in the church identify and exercise his or her gifts. Why not? Why is that so important? Why does it matter whether I find my spiritual gift or gifts and exercise it or them? Why does that matter?
Because we're all part of one body.
He describes
the jobs that they're assigned to do, where the body's not complete.
In Romans and in 1 Corinthians, chapter 12, chapter 12, chapter 12, chapter 12, he talks about the picture of the body. You got a body where a foot doesn't work, the body's not really working well. One part hurts, they all hurt. For it to function, all the parts have to function. And if a part quits functioning, you've got problems. So he wants to know how important it is that everybody know what their spiritual gifts are. Learn how to exercise them.
He spends a lot of time, too, talking about the origin of the gifts, the oneness of God, the Spirit, you know, different kinds of gifts, but the same Spirit, different kinds of service, but the same Lord, different kinds of working, but the same God.
Yeah, we got lots of parts, but we're one body. And it's really interesting. He wants them to know that God has put together into the church the people and the gifts that he wants that church to have. Which follows that he wants us not to criticize each other or ourselves for the gifts we don't have. He wants us to celebrate the gifts we do have. Yes, sir.
Years ago, we went to a spiritual gifts class, about 4 weeks long, trying to figure out what our gifts were. At the end of it, the leader said, all right, the people with gifts of demonstration stand here, the gift of helps, the gift. And by the time we got done, we were all standing, and he looked at all the different gifts, and there were more with helps than there were administration or teaching. And he said, now that's a church. You can go out and be a church. Because there are just enough gifts in the right amount of areas that that would work.
What if the whole body were an eye, he says at one place? Where would the walking be? Where would the hearing be? Where would the smelling be? Or if the whole body was a nose, who's going to see? God's putting together both people and the gifts those people have to build a church. The whole of 1 Corinthians 13 is expressing the thought that every spiritual gift needs to be exercised in love. Love is the thing that makes all the spiritual gifts work. If we try to exercise whatever spiritual gifts we have and we don't have love, it's not going to work. Spiritual gifts exercised properly should build up or knit together the church. This is sort of, he's been all the way around, and now he comes back to that theme of the one who gives the gifts is one. One God gives the gifts. He wants one body to result. And finally, that the gifts should be exercised in humility and not in pride. If I think, oh, I'm gifted in this, and my nose starts to go up, I'm in trouble right away. I'm in trouble right away. Questions that might come along with this are, do we know what spiritual gifts are? Do we know what ours are? Are they being used in our church to bring the church together? Do we know how important it is for every person in the church, everyone who's a professing believer, to know about this? Do we appreciate the fact that everybody who's here is here because of God's actions and God's leadership? Do we criticize people for the gifts they don't have? There was somebody in the first hour who said they've been working for a while with somebody who looks real hard at spiritual gifts. And they said, it seems like in churches we have people who realize they don't do something well. And so they start going to workshops and reading books and all this kind of thing, trying to do that better. And the guy says, I think that's exactly the wrong thing to do. Things you don't do so well. Fine. What are the things you do well? That's maybe where God's gifted you. Exercise that. Instead, we always seem to be, he says, worrying about the things we don't do very well and either feel bad about it, quit doing anything. There was another person sitting roughly in there where you all are, Rusty and Molly, who said he's not sure what his spiritual gifts are. I think that means we as a church have fallen down and helping each other find out what our spiritual gifts are, and I worry about that. Because he wasn't sure what his spiritual gifts were, but he was trying out lots of different things. Because he said he feels like if he just starts to begin to do things, he'll find some of those things go better and some of those things go not so good, and he'll figure out. And I think that's the time-tested method. That's certainly what our church talks about, encouraging people to join work here and join work there. Try it out for a while, see how it goes. And I think many of you have heard that language used if you've been invited to do one thing or another. Okay?
You know, the comment that you made about how church people tend to go to workshops and read books to do the thing that they don't do so well speaks to our human pride, that we want to have it all ourselves, we want to do it all ourselves, rather than partnering with someone for whom that is their spiritual gift and letting them do the piece that they do well.
I'm quoting a friend of mine. It is very liberating to suddenly realize I'm not expected to do it all. I'm expected to work with other people, and together we can do all the things God calls us to do. 2 Corinthians chapter 1. We're in 1 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians chapter 1. This one goes back to being a little more subtle. You've got a little bit of work to do here. Verse 8, middle of the verse, you should see that phrase. Do you see it? Concordances are wonderful. I now have
sounds like the joke you were saying. For we do not want you to be ignorant, comma, brethren, comma.
So it actually comes in that way in your translation.
Uninformed.
Mine says we want you to be quite certain, brothers, about. Now, I'm going to give you a moment or two. Read maybe through verse 7. Verse 11. Read through verse 11 and see if you can tease out what it is that has caused this thought to rise so high. Now, once again, this is early in the letter. So it may be he's setting the tone for all the other things he's going to say, because remember in Paul's letters sometimes there's an issue, there's a problem, and he's going to be critical of the people. But what is it he wants them to be absolutely certain of? What is it he wants them not to be ignorant of? See if you can put this together. I think there's 3 points this time. See if you can get them. And I'm getting them in the order in which he presents them. What's the first one? It's tough to do the things Paul was doing. What was Paul doing? He was a Christian leader. He was somebody who was out on the front lines, if you will. It can be tough to be a leader in a Christian setting. That can be really, really tough. What's the key to dealing with all those problems? Can you get the second point? Do you hear the connection between what we just talked about back in Corinthians, in 1 Corinthians? To quit relying on yourself and realize the only hope you have is to rely on God.
There's a real important little piece in there that I'm glad he inserted, even somewhat of his faith in. Is at the end of 8 where it says, you know, well, it says, we were under great pressure, far beyond our ability to endure, so that we despaired even of life.
Mine says we gave up all hope even
exactly.
Of surviving.
I like yours better, because that's just what I was getting the sense of here, and yours says it. Look, we were under such pressure that we even gave up hope. Mm-hmm. But then you read on. So it's not like these superheroes, or he's addressing them as a superhero who's saying, you know, just let me tell you, yeah, these things are going to come, and, you know,
you just tough them out.
You overcome them because God's there with you. He tells them.
If you're going deeper than we did the first hour. Let's stay deep and see how he words this. We gave up all hope even of surviving. In fact, this is verse 9, we were carrying the sentence of death within our own selves, so that we should be forced to trust not in ourselves, but in God who raises the dead. It's a beautiful piece there, but if you want just the bullet points, the bullet point is, it's tough or can be tough to be a Christian leader. And the key to getting through that is to finally realize you can't put any trust in yourself. Your trust has to be fully and wholly on God. Now, he goes deeper, and the way he goes is really revealing of the depth of his issues. But that's only the second point. The third point is in verse 11. Have you found it yet? The people that you serve who pray for you make the crucial difference. We have Christian leaders in our church. For some of them, it's gotten tough. What's the key? I suspect the key is they got to learn to trust God and not themselves. Because every Christian leader struggles with that. What is the one piece that's essential for that to actually work? We have to pray for them. And we have to pray for them knowing that this is one of the crucial battles that has to be fought. I don't think I'm going to say a whole lot more, but I'll simply say that's a recipe for some solution of some of the issues we face within our church right now, I think. And those of you who see one or another aspect of it, you may be able to see what I'm talking about. There are tough times that come in the life of any church, and our church is not immune from that. The key is the leaders for whom life gets tough, for them to realize there's a God that they can trust and a God they must trust. And that transition is affected, it's made effective by the prayers of the people for whom and with whom and to whom they serve. That's big. Comments? First Thessalonians chapter 4. First Thessalonians chapter 4. I'm not going to hit all of them. I'm going to hit some of them. First Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 13. While you're looking, let me just tell you, if you look in Matthew 24, you'll find Jesus saying almost the same thing, except this is the way he says it. Don't let people deceive you. Don't let people pull the wool over your eyes. Don't let people blind you to spiritual truth. Okay? Ignorance can come by the active work of somebody trying to mislead or misinform or deceive you. But it's interesting to see what things Jesus says. Don't be deceived about this. Make sure you get this right, essentially, is what he's saying. Okay, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 13. Did you find that phrase? And what is it this time?
But we would not have you ignorant, comma, brethren.
We would not have you ignorant, comma, brethren. You got King James? Goodness gracious, I didn't. That's NIV or something?
Revised.
Revised, RSV? Okay. I would not have you ignorant, comma, brethren. In fact, that's the way I've learned to say it, simply because I remember that joke and think it's so funny. What is it this time? We want you to understand the nature of death so that it is no longer a problem or an issue for you. We want you to know that God cares for you and has made provision for you. And you can trust that and put that aside as a concern. And get on with living the life God has in front of you. The first hour attendance is on average a little older than the attendance in this hour. But there are some younger folks who visit with us and who are guests with us and who are regular members with us. One of those younger folks is actually in college in another state, and we keep track of him and help him a bit. He was back today from his studies. And he asked for a minute of time because he hadn't seen, he only gets to see us a couple of times a year. And he quoted for us a hymn. He's a music major at this school. He quoted for us a hymn that he sings every night. And I think it was the fifth verse, the fourth verse of that hymn. He said, Lord, may I see the grave as of no more concern to me than my bed, so that I can lie down and sleep in peace. Great line. Great line. Paul says, I don't want the thought of death to be something that preoccupies you or cause you concern. I want you to know God loves you and he has made provision for you. And you don't have to be concerned about that. Now, almost out of time, let me tell you that if you go to 2 Peter chapter 3. 2 Peter, I thought we were going to Paul. Yeah, 2 Peter, because Peter gets in on this too. I've got about five more. I'm going to just do this one and then we'll come to a stop. 2 Peter chapter 3. Verse 8. 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 8. Peter words it this way. There's one thing I don't ever want you to forget. Now, what's the difference? All the others we've been talking about, the assumption is not you already know this. The assumption is you may not know this and it's vital that you do. That's the word ignorant, right? This one, Peter says, there's one thing I want to make sure you don't forget. What does that imply? You know it, but if you ever take your eyes off of it and lose sight of it, you might be in trouble. Read it and tell me what it is. What is it he says you don't want to ever forget?
That God's not bound by time.
That God does not see or experience time the same way we do. We get a copy of the Religious Herald every week. That's the Virginia Baptist, the Baptist newspaper for the Virginia Baptist organization. and I can't remember now if it was 6 months ago or a year ago, but fairly recently, there was a series of articles in there talking about a group of Baptists, I'll give them well-meaning, who believe that God experiences time exactly the way we do. That is, God has no idea what's going to happen tomorrow. And I reject that with everything I am. And this is one of the verses that teaches me that. It isn't by far the only one, but it's the one that Peter has attached the words to that connect us with the things we're talking about today. God does not see or experience time the way we do. He is different from us and separate from us. And we can trust Him because He sees things in ways that we don't, that line up better with reality. Now, I hope I've given you some things to think about today. We've got two or three more if you want to see them. You can come up afterwards and look. But I do want to take you one place. In the process of studying this week, I ran across a verse which for this week is my favorite verse. I may have another favorite verse next week. But it's in Psalm chapter 40. It's the last verse. It's the first half of the last verse. And I'm curious to know how yours reads it. I know how mine does.
Psalm 40.
Psalm 40. Last verse should be verse 17. And it's the first half of that verse. Mine is in poetic form, so it's the first two lines of a four-line stanza. Poor and needy as I am, the Lord has me in mind. Good verse. Good verse. I commend that to you, and I want us to use that as our benediction. Poor and needy though we are, God has each of us in mind. We can count on that. You all have a good day.